once I, my eyes became open, I think, to what was happening, not only on a global public health scale of how our food system really is really contributing to a lot of our ailments and our, you know, obesity epidemic, all of these chronic diseases that we see and things like that. But it also connected me with the environment and animals and how our food choices really impact that. And I think that all of that circled back into my mind of like, okay, this is the stuff that's really important to me. And if I can still be a strong and competitive athlete, then that's the perfect combination right there.
Hi, beautiful souls. That was Jackson Long. And this is Follow Your Kind podcast with your host, me, Christina. I am very excited to share the conversation with you. Jackson is just an amazing being. He's very well-versed in plant-based nutrition, endurance sports, and how those two collide. He's an athlete. He's a podcast host himself. He's currently working on his master's degree in applied nutrition and developing an amazing course for endurance athletes and being able to do that and thriving on a plant-based diet. And I highly recommend that. And I will keep you posted as soon as it's released. And he also, in his young years, have already been a speaker on TEDx. And he did a TEDx talk called Make Pooping Great Again. Highly recommend you check it out. It's a lot of fun, but it's also pretty revealing information that most of us don't think about. It's about fiber, its importance, and its lack of in American population and worldwide population, really. I'm also excited to share this with you because it's a little bit of a continuation of a tradition that Jackson and Aaron started last year. So Aaron is Jackson's partner in crime as they started the Food for Thought podcast. They both are moving on to bigger and better things now, which I'm excited for them, but a little bit sad about. But they have started this tradition of Fiber February last year. So they did this extensive research on the benefits of fiber, importance of fiber, and really promoting the fiber in our daily life last year. So everything they were doing, the podcasts, the posts, everything was about fiber, and the hashtag was Fiber February. And it was this big social media campaign that they got a lot of people to participate in. So they currently are, as I said, moving on to bigger and better and exciting things for themselves. So the podcast is no longer live, but I thought it would be amazing for me to partake in the tradition and invite Jackson on my podcast this time and continue the tradition of Fiber February. So we're going to talk about fiber. We're also going to talk about endurance sports in general and Jackson's journey and some of the realizations that he came to. He is sharing some of his strategies, some of the things that he's working on, some of the exciting things that are coming up his way. And yeah, I hope you enjoy that. Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Follow Your Kind podcast. And today on the show, I am thrilled to introduce to you Jackson Long, who is a mountain athlete, a podcaster, a speaker himself. He's a nutritionist, a nutrition researcher, a photographer and videographer, and the owner of the voice that you're about to hear that has taken a celebrity life of its own. Hi, Jackson.
Celebrity life of its own. Wow, never been introduced in that way. I appreciate that. It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much for having me. I really do appreciate it.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to the conversation. So I'm really glad we had a quick chat before we started. And I'm really glad that you said that you're okay with that and looking forward to talking about fiber. I'm really happy to be a part of continuing the tradition that you have started with your partner in crime, Aaron, from last year. So we'll go with hashtag Fiber February, right?
Yeah, let's start with that. I think that's a great place to start. It's hard to believe it's already been a year. That's insane.
It is really crazy. So yeah, let's start with that. I remember listening to your podcast like a while ago. It was actually you were being interviewed on somebody else's podcast, you and Aaron. And I really, really enjoyed kind of your lighthearted attitude about plant-based nutrition and how you were talking about living epic life, doing really cool stuff, and then focusing on getting as much fiber as you can. So can you talk what Fiber February is and kind of your take on that?
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, it kind of started, I guess, so, you know, for those of you that are listening that don't know, back in 2016, my friend Aaron Stuber and I started a podcast called Thought for Food. And it, you know, it's really focused on kind of trying to fill this space in the world of nutrition science, and particularly in plant-based nutrition science, where it's, you know, just this really evidence-based approach to living this lifestyle and making it fun and making it lighthearted and approachable and practical without, you know, having it be around dogma and drama and all that. And so it kind of naturally evolved to us talking about poop, as boys do. But really it was rooted in this concept that we kind of recognized, was that like fiber is this nutrient that is so underrated and that is yet so important, and something that I think obviously the majority of the population doesn't recognize and appreciate in the way that we did once we kind of went down the rabbit hole of learning about fiber and its benefits and its importance in the diet, and just kind of understanding how ridiculously deficient we are as a nation and as world in fiber. And it kind of then sparked this just like light bulb moment for us that like, wow, this is a really good way to talk about plant-based nutrition, plant-based diets, and kind of allowing it to be sort of the Trojan horse to get people to think about these things, because, you know, 97% of Americans don't eat enough fiber, and fiber is only found in plant foods. And so as a result, it's like, you know, logically, if you're eating a plant-based diet, you're going to get more fiber. And if you're not eating enough fiber, it's probably because you're not eating enough plants. And so that's sort of what kind of sparked that. And then we just decided, well, fiber starts with F, February is coming up. Let's do a whole campaign on the podcast and kind of social media at large about trying to raise awareness about fiber. So we did a whole series of podcasts about fiber and talking about it, and learning about it and sharing it with the world. And so, we both are definitely fiber fanatics.
That is really cool. And I remember following you guys and the group that you were facilitating on social media. And it was just really, really cool to see the awareness that you were bringing to this topic, and how a lot of people were surprised just about the facts that they were learning. But then also a lot of people were just so excited that they were able to now eat this amount of food and posting all these recipes and enjoying their life without having to look at it from the perspective of scarcity. And as you said, getting the plants in and getting the fiber in. So I also know you pursued this topic much, much further, and you did a TED talk, TEDx talk. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's something that has been an interest of mine for a while, is, you know, figuring out ways to, and it's sort of the purpose of, you know, my master's degree and everything that I do. It's like, I'm really passionate about nutrition education, and I'm really fascinated by, you know, different modes of communication for sharing these topics, because obviously there's this huge disconnect between the understanding and awareness of optimal nutrition and lifestyles with, you know, the general population and people, even, you know, very specific types of people like athletes in Boulder, Colorado, for example. There's a big disconnect between what people think that they know and what they're actually doing. And so I found that humor is a really great way to help people learn, you know, not just about nutrition, but learn about different topics. I mean, I think that's why we resonated so much with, you know, Bill Nye, the Science Guy's kids, for those of you that grew up watching Bill Nye or other similar, you know, kind of funny, but also really educational, you know, shows or pieces of content. And so I think what kind of spurred me on was this, you know, I'm sort of immature in many ways, and I'm a guy, and I, you know, like fart and poop jokes often, like many guys do. And so I recognize that, you know, fiber is such an important thing. And so it's a great way to talk about it is, you know, obviously fiber does contribute to improving our bowel movements and bowel function, and everybody poops. And it's just a fact, it's a reality. Boys, girls, dogs, cats, cheetahs, we all poop. And as a result, it's kind of this common universal topic that we can talk about. And yeah, it's kind of taboo and it's tongue in cheek and it's uncomfortable for a lot of people, But I think that's a big part of why we are struggling with fiber and struggling to talk about our gut health, because it's become this taboo subject in our society, much like religion or sex and other topics. And so my purpose with the TED Talk was to just, you know, throw everything out on the table and just be my goofy, weird, kind of sort of immature self, but also slam it home with some science and talk about this and show the dire situation that we're in, because it really is. And, you know, our digestive system is obviously this critical and super important system in our body. And so I wanted to talk about that. So I think that's what really spurred me on. And I think about these things. And so I applied to do the TED Talk, and the committee loved it. The idea that I pitched for it, and it kind of evolved over time, and it was perfectly weaved into Fiber February because the talk was in April. And so it was doing the whole Fiber February really kind of solidified in my mind how I wanted to approach the talk. And so, yeah, the talk was great. It was, it was a really great talk, but I messed up a few times on stage, which is fine. It was a little bit scarring because I was like my first ever public speaking endeavor. But as a TED Talk, it's like kind of go big or go home. But it was a really fun experience, and it was a really cool thing and a real gift to be able to share that with people.
This is incredible. I still cannot believe that you go from no public speaking to public speaking as a TED speaker. I mean, this is like a quantum jump. But I also want to talk about the fact that, as you said, the your approach, I think it's such a wonderful and wise approach to make things less intimidating, approaching things with humor, but then at the same time, not just taking opinions, but having a foundation of evidence-based science behind it. So, and I'm sure that it's, you know, it's so much more credible than a lot of other sources that we have nowadays, but yet you still take it with humor and you're still able to have fun, which also is the name of the TEDx talk that you have. Because can you say that? Because I would love for you to say that. It makes me smile every time I look at it.
Make pooping great again?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, just that in itself, just the name, like you don't even need to listen. I mean, you should definitely go listen to the talk, but just the name of the talk, I just think it's like so wise and witty.
Yeah. Cause I mean, it's like there's a lot there, and I don't want to get too political on the podcast, but like, you know, we're living in this era now where there's science is being discredited. There's a lot of doubt. There's a lot of, news and in the media, there's a lot of negativity being thrown around when it comes to science and evidence and data. And so obviously even something as small as fiber and the importance on our gut, like there's a lot of misinformation out there, and there's a lot of confusion in just the general population. And so, you know, it's like make pooping great again. It's like this kind of funny, relevant, you know, sort of title that I think helps to kind of break down the walls and let us talk about this stuff. And one of the funniest things about doing Fiber February, about doing the TED Talk, about, you know, doing the different podcasts that we've mentioned about fiber is just the amount of messages that we've gotten from people that were like, wow, it's so cool that you're so open about talking about these things, from guys and girls and, you know, young kids to, you know, elderly adults. It's like, it's all across the board. Again, we all poop, and it's something that a lot of people struggle with is gut stuff. And, you know, we're not trying to be doctors or gastroenterologists, but we're just trying to share the science of like what it says when, you know, what it's like when we eat a diet predominantly, you know, made up of plant foods that's high in fiber. And so it's just been this really rewarding experience to be able to connect with people about this topic. And I never really expected that would happen, but fiber is, yeah, it's just this incredible nutrient that I think is so underrated and yet is so important, and that the vast majority of our population doesn't get enough of. And, you know, it's like I talk about in the talk and elsewhere, it's like everyone's so obsessive with protein, of course, and other, you know, macronutrients, micronutrients. Everybody likes to obsess about breaking apart nutrition and food into all these component parts, but we're kind of leaving fiber off the table and not even giving it the credit that it deserves for just how amazing it is.
Absolutely. And I want to also bring out again what you mentioned earlier to the listeners, is that 97% of Americans do not get enough fiber, and very few people talk about it. While everybody's concerned, where do we get our protein and how many people are deficient in protein in America? Probably very few.
Right, right, exactly. And so I think that's the key, is like we just don't even realize, you know, how crazy it is that we're obsessed with protein when most of us get, like you said, more than enough except for potentially, you know, high level elite athletes, but we can talk about that later. But it's just like, we average a ridiculously low amount, you know, like 12 to 15 grams a day. And it's really not that hard to be reaching, you know, the minimum recommended intake, and even like the minimum intake. And I highly recommend going and listening to our podcast on What's the Deal with Fiber, mm-hmm. because we really dive into the science and what some of the epidemiology looks at. But how optimally and how evolutionarily we're sort of designed, our physiology was designed to be eating, you know, 50, 75, even 100 grams of fiber a day, which is like, you know, 5-10 times more than we eat in general at the average person. And so I think we could be so much better off if we just focused on it. I mean, obviously this gets into a greater conversation about breaking foods into their component parts and having a reductionist approach. But if we're going to focus on one nutrient, I think we should focus on fiber a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. And even as you mentioned, even the recommendations that we currently have in place, even those are relatively low in comparison to what some other scientists suggest and what evidence shows, and still we're not able to reach those recommendations.
Right. I mean, it's amazing what we've seen in the research with people that are eating, you know, upwards of 50 to 100 grams of fiber a day, and we barely reach 20 grams on average as a society. And yeah, if we can, you know, get to that, you know, 25, 30 grams a day recommended intake, that's a step forward, but we're not going to necessarily reach our optimal, you know, level of health and prevention of disease and, you know, quality of digestion. And it, you know, the amount of fiber that we're eating and the amount of, you know, healthy bowel movements we're having a day is reflective of what we eat. And I think that that's, again, like fiber is just one piece of plant foods, but it's really reflective of what we eat. And it's like I'd say kind of at the end of my talk, it's like if you're having amazing, you know, multiple times a day, you know, dumps basically every day, like what does that mean? Let's work backwards. It means that you're eating a lot of fiber, because fiber is, you know, extremely important in helping to bulk up stool and have a healthy microbiome, which is going to help with your digestion. And then back up from there, well, if you're eating a lot of fiber, you're eating a ton of plant foods, and because fiber exists only in plant foods and whole plant foods. I mean, we don't see this kind of health benefits and just impact with dietary supplements like Metamucil and stuff like that. And so if you're eating a ton of fiber, you're eating a ton of plants. And if you're eating a ton of plants, you know, it gets into the philosophical, you know, discussion of your having a much more positive impact on our planet. You're not contributing as much to the global suffering of animals, and you're also, you know, setting yourself up for a long and healthy life that's rich with, you know, experiences and a high quality of life, health span, instead of just longevity. And so, yeah, it's a really cool topic for me, and it's fun to talk about, because it's not something that I get to talk to a lot of people about on a regular basis, but when they do bring it up, it's a really important topic for sure.
Absolutely. And it also helps prevent or fight constipation. And I'm sure people are much happier when they're having regular bowel movements.
Exactly. If that's the only thing that it does, and it's not, but if it was, like, we would be super happy, because I think constipation is unfortunately a very common problem. It's a common problem in kids. It's a common problem in a lot of people. And I think, you know, it's just a shame that it's in major part, I think, due to eating diets high in processed foods and animal foods, not enough fiber-rich plant foods. And it's really not that hard to reach that minimum target.
Yeah. So for those who are not aware, maybe don't have like a good visual image of what a good day of whole food fiber eating food looks like, can you give like a generic menu, breakfast, lunch, dinner, what it would look like for us to get a sufficient amount of fiber?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's maybe to start, there's two main types of fiber. You know, the soluble fiber, which kind of dissolves in water, and it's, you know, kind of found in things like oatmeal and beans and lentils, you know, some fruits and stuff. And there's insoluble fiber, which doesn't dissolve in water. And that's the kind of fiber that helps to bulk up our poop and move our food that we've eaten through our colon and kind of absorb the water, and helps to, you know, improve that regularity and prevent constipation. And so insoluble fiber sources are, you know, things like whole grains, other kinds of fruits and vegetables. And so, you know, the key is, you don't really need to know that, but the key is like, if you're eating a variety of whole plant foods, you're going to get a variety of both soluble and insoluble fiber. And so, you know, it's one of those things where you don't really have to think about fiber if you're eating a diet that is rich in whole plant foods. It's like, so for example, like, maybe today I'll walk you through sort of what I ate. I mean, you know, I had some buckwheat whole grain pancakes this morning with fruit. And so I'm getting a nice mix of both soluble and insoluble fiber. Blueberries, great source of soluble fiber. And then of course, whole grains like buckwheat, you know, you're going to get the insoluble fiber there. Some almond butter. And then for lunch and dinner, I had the same thing, because it was just leftovers, but this kind of big Asian stir fry, cabbage, lots of cabbage. I had some fermented red cabbage and beet, like sauerkraut, with some tofu and rice. So, you know, it's, again, like, we can break it down into, you know, every food that we're eating, but it's more about the overall pattern, the overall consistency throughout the course of a week or a month or a year that's really going to make the difference. And I always recommend to people that maybe aren't as used to eating as much fiber, or used to eating a really whole foods, plant-based diet, is ease into it. You know, don't get too ahead of yourself and go from suddenly eating, you know, 10 or 15, 20 grams of fiber a day to 100 grams of fiber a day. You're going to be miserable. And then you're going to think, wow, this whole fiber thing is a hoax. Jackson is being ridiculous. And this, you know, you're going to get bloating and gas, and you're going to have stomach aches. Your body's not going to be able to digest it, because your microbiome isn't used to, you know, digesting and absorbing that amount of fiber. And so it's something you have to work up towards. I think a lot of people struggle with that, and, you know, digestion and the microbiome is a finicky thing. But again, this is why we have to feed, you know, because fiber is a prebiotic. It's what feeds the microbes in our gut, you know, their food. And so a lot of people like to talk about probiotics, but it doesn't really matter what's, you know, what you're putting in terms of probiotics if they're not being fed correctly. And so we have to put that stuff in, but we have to ease up to it and allow that that microbiome and that gut flora to adapt and evolve into being able to consume that. So yeah, take it slow and remember that it's a process, and it doesn't have to be perfect overnight.
That is wonderful advice. I want to sum up the advice around fiber. You're saying whole foods, ease up slowly and gradually, building up the intake of the fiber, emphasize variety. Are there any other things that can help people both build up to the good amount of fiber and also ensure that their digestion is going smoothly? I imagine water, drinking lots of water is very important.
Yeah, I was going to say water for sure. I think, you know, and I'm still working on this. You know, it's winter time here in Colorado, and even though it's still super dry, I struggle to drink enough water. Just, you know, busy day. It's not necessarily hot. I don't really crave water, but water is super important for digestion, especially with insoluble fiber, because it actually sucks up water out of your large intestine to help move, you know, your poop through your colon. And so when you're increasing your fiber a lot, you're also going to be increasing that water loss and, you know, that water utilization in the gut. And so you kind of have to compensate for that with more water. And I think that's another big epidemic in our society is dehydration, not eating or not drinking enough water to combat, you know, digestive issues. And so, yeah, water's critical. I think, you know, for athletes, and we can certainly talk about this when we, you know, shift into talking mm-hmm. about athletes, but, you know, athletes do have to be careful about too much fiber. I mean, it's a balance, right? We can't just immediately go into like, yeah, fiber is the secret. We have to eat as much fiber as we possibly can. For athletes and for other people, like sometimes it's uncomfortable to be, you know, farting and pooping all day. It's just, it's hard to live and exist in the world, with, you know, our various, you know, commitments in our lives. And so especially for athletes, I would be careful with it, especially around either competition or periods of heavy training, because it does take a lot of energy for your gut to process that. There's a lot of food and volume in your stomach, in your gut. And there can be a lot of GI issues for athletes that overdo with fiber.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Okay. Well, I love it. Let's transition out now. I would love you to share a little bit of your story of mm-hmm. how you found, plant-based nutrition. Maybe that will be a good segue for us to transition towards athletes and, plant-based eating and how the diet may look different for them.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's kind of an interesting story, but probably not super uncommon. I think my story probably relates to a lot of people, especially athletes. You know, I grew up in a small ski town in Idaho and, you know, fell in love with endurance sports from a pretty young age. I was a cyclist and a cross country ski racer all through middle and high school. And then I moved to Colorado, to Boulder, to go to school at CU, University of Colorado. And was racing at a high level. You know, as a junior, I did some racing in Europe. I did the Junior Tour of Ireland, a few races in Europe, and raced kind of all over the country. And then I wanted to, you know, my dream was to become a professional cyclist, as a lot of young cyclists have and young athletes in general. And so I came to Boulder for two reasons. You know, I wanted to study physiology at the at CU's program, because their integrated physiology program is amazing. I had dreams and aspirations of being an orthopedic surgeon, actually, and that quickly fizzled out as soon as I realized how ridiculous med school is and all of the requirements for that, and trying to also be a professional bike racer. Those two things weren't really mixing for me early on in school. So I was racing for the school. I was racing for like a local elite team, and we were, you know, ranked number one in the country for amateur teams. And, you know, I was really serious. And I was the one pivotal season, I decided to take the spring semester off from school to focus on racing. And I went down and lived in Tucson, Arizona for the winter, you know, to train, because it snows here in Colorado. It's very unpredictable. And I was getting ready for all the early season races. And as the youngest guy on the team, there was a lot of pressure, mostly from myself, but, you know, from coaches and team directors and parents and all of that. And as a result, I got really kind of tunnel visioned into, you know, training, obviously, but also what I was eating. And I wasn't super, you know, I didn't, like many athletes, I didn't really know that much about what optimal nutrition for athletes looked like. I read a lot of different books and blogs and just kind of confused. And as a result, I was kind of in this place where I was, you know, counting all my calories, very obsessive about food and very obsessive about weight and how much I weighed and, you know, and all of that, because cycling is a very, you know, power to weight kind of activity. And so, long story short, I got way too skinny. And as a result, it just completely kind of ruined my entire season and undermined my health. I got walking pneumonia. I was like basically anemic. And I just, I didn't finish any of the early season races. I was miserable. And it just kind of created this cascade of things that I just like made me realize that, wow, I really need to take a step back and rethink what I'm eating and why. And so that's sort of what kind of launched me on this path of becoming interested in nutrition. And granted, I was studying it and studying in the physiology side of it and in school in my undergrad program. But I found myself during that time, like applying all the stuff I was learning in my physiology classes to nutrition. And I sort of stumbled upon, you know, plant-based athletes like Rich Roll and Brendan Brazier and, you know, Soft Forks Over Knives. And then that's sort of when I was like, okay, I'm going to do this vegan thing. It's totally different and radical than what I'm used to, but I have a pretty obsessive personality. And so I was just like, okay, let's do it. And so basically overnight I went vegan and immediately started feeling a pretty amazing. Like I was sleeping a lot better. My congestion kind of disappeared. And obviously I started eating enough calories to survive. And so I gained a lot of weight back and just started feeling a lot better. And then that's sort of when I realized like, wow, this plant-based diet thing really just makes sense from all aspects. Not just
were you still health. Training then?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So I was still racing and training, although that was kind of my last like very serious season. I finished out that season. And then I raced another year on a different team, but I sort of began to recognize that being a professional cyclist wasn't really what I wanted to do. I cared more about being a more whole and balanced athlete and human first and foremost. And, mm-hmm. and if some racing is in there, that's great. But the nutrition stuff was really what was inspiring me. And so I kind of, yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to take a quick step back. I'm curious, how were your peers reacting to the changes? And did you tell them that you were making changes in diet? I imagine you probably had a coach or a nutritionist or registered dietitian as a part of the team, or maybe somebody who was observing you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was kind of a closet vegan for a few months, actually. I didn't really tell anyone because I was like, I don't know if this is going to work. And I don't know if my, you know, muscles are just going to disappear. Like I didn't really know what I was doing. And actually that's sort of how I met Aaron. And you know, because I like, he was the only plant-based athlete I knew in Boulder. And so I think what happened was, like once I started to kind of talk to my peers and my coaches and different people, they were definitely hesitant. They were just like, well, you know, cause they also came to me and said, Jackson, you don't look very good. You know, you're looking, you know, too skinny and obviously you're kind of struggling in these races. Like what's going on? And so they were kind of the ones that saw that from the outside as well. Mm-hmm. And so then I think once they saw or hearing me talk about this vegan diet thing, they were also concerned. I mean, as they should be, you know, it's a lot of people use a vegan diet as another sort of form of disordered eating. And so for me, it wasn't like that at all. And, but it definitely was something that I was like very myself kind of thing for a little while. And then once I gave it some time and kind of figured out how to do it, I mean, it's my personality to like dive into the research and like learn everything I possibly can about it. So once I felt confident and comfortable in why I was doing it and how, then I sort of opened up a little bit more about it.
Mm-hmm. That is really cool. I just admire your courage. Well, first of all, courage for both, for making the changes and, you know, like being on this path and being a competitive cyclist to be able to try new things and then see how it works for yourself and test it out in yourself. But also, as you said, kind of going, jumping a little bit forward in your biography, just having the courage to also stand up for yourself and seek that balance and see beyond just, you know, immediate rewards of competing and focus on just one area of your life and also working on your overall being and overall kind of your presence as a human contributing to this world and to this society beyond just cycling. I think it takes a lot of courage to step out of that.
Yeah, totally. And it sort of, I think, foreshadows how I am now currently in the way that I approach things and kind of my new path of the things that I'm interested in. I think I realized in that moment that like I was in a pretty bad spot with my health and just my mind. And like, I think I recognized that you know, pro cycling isn't the path that I want to be on for my whole life. And I want to be a healthy and happy human, first and foremost. And that I think the way that I was eating was not conducive to that. And as a result, my eyes became open, I think, to what was happening, not only on a global public health scale of how, you know, our diet and our just our food system really is really contributing to a lot of our ailments and our, you know, obesity epidemic, all of these chronic diseases that we see and things like that. But it also connected me with the environment and animals and how our food choices really impact that. And I think that all of that, you know, circled back into my mind of like, okay, this is the stuff that's really important to me. And if I can still be a strong and competitive athlete, then, you know, that's the perfect combination right there. Like that, obviously that stuff comes first, and being an athlete is a very, in many ways, a very selfish sort of venture. And especially as a singular kind of sport like cycling, it's very selfish, and you spend a lot of time training by yourself, and you kind of are in this little tunnel vision mode of training and sleeping and recovering and racing and eating. And it's hard to step out of that sometimes and see the bigger picture. And I just got really inspired by the opportunity to kind of do both or try to do both, and recognize that food and nutrition is something that we have so much control over for the most part. And for most of us, if we have that privilege, what better thing to control than what we put into our mouths three times a day? And so I think that really just resonated with me. And I really like the idea of athletes that are also, that are humans first and foremost, that are contributing in a positive way, that are eating in a way that reflects their commitment to our environment, to these places that we get to ride our bikes in or run in beautiful places. And also, you know, have compassion and be stewards for animals that can't defend themselves, or, you know, that are just being unnecessarily harmed in as just for our pleasure, basically. And so that combined with performance nutrition is sort of, you know, how I've evolved and sort of what inspired me to go down this path.
That's amazing. I love your approach. And I see that, at least from my perspective, and correct me if I'm wrong, but at least from my perspective, it seems like you're taking it in many areas of your life now. So you're stepping out of the kind of extremism with sports and focusing more on being balanced, and maybe rather having fun with the athletic things that you do, and still going on adventures and kicking ass as you did with all the races that you did, the Crusher and Tusher race that you did, and many other ones, but at the same time focusing more on having fun rather than, you know, killing yourself just for the purpose of a title or a medal. And then it also seems to me that you are taking similar approach with your dietary choices. Yes, you're very passionate about how you approach the food and that you choose to put in your plate, but at the same time you're not being like all or nothing, black or white. I remember you going, what is the race, the fundraising that you did, cycling outside of the United States, when you raised money, Mercy for Animals, and you still made a commitment to like have fun along the way, and, you know, not being like too strict or dogmatic about making sure that it was like 100% vegan, but I mean, doing your best with choosing the plant-based nutrition, but at the same time, like not, you know, giving up your life just to, you know, stick to their principles.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, it's a fun thing to be able to, you know, do both and be, and I recognize how privileged I am to be able to, you know, be able to live in a place like Boulder, or, you know, have the time to be able to, you know, go ride my bike or run. And I love it. It's a huge part of my identity and who I am. But it's like you said, there's so much more to life than being an athlete, at least for me. And I think that also kind of rolls over into diet. And I see, you know, one of the big things that I see within, you know, the plant-based or the vegan community is just this sort of like dogmatism about diet and like being so obsessed with food. And you know, I went through that phase as well. And so I understand it. I can relate to it, but I also don't feel like I necessarily relate super strongly to, you know, the kind of mainstream vegan community, because it's so focused on food. And so, you know, there's a lot of orthorexia, which is just kind of like this, you know, negative obsession with making your diet as healthy as possible. And I recognize that, you know, we have to do something about our healthcare crisis. And sometimes for some people that are diseased, a radical approach can be incredibly beneficial. But I also think that, like you said, it's not that, it doesn't have to be so black and white. Obviously, from an ethical perspective, if you're an ethical vegan, and I very much am, it is pretty black and white to a certain extent. Like, I just don't eat animals. But it's also a lot easier than I think a lot of people think to just live in the world and exist no matter where you are and just do the best you can, but also to live your life and be able to, you know, like you mentioned, our trip to the Alps in Europe, and you know, my two friends and I, we just went on this adventure and just like lived out of Airbnbs up in the mountains in Europe and rode our bikes for 5 or 6 hours a day and ate beans and bread and pasta. And like, it wasn't the healthiest, but we were just literally trying to fuel ourselves to get up over these gigantic mountains. And so I think that's a big part of my message and my approach is like, yeah, we can, you know, you can be fully 100% vegan and also do these things, but you also don't have to be fully 100% vegan. You can step into it, lean into it in a way that feels comfortable for you. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. And I think if we just got more people to consume more plants, more fiber, eat in a way that's more compassionate and more sustainable, our world would be better off. And I see a lot of, I think, vegans shooting themselves in the foot, honestly, by taking a really radical approach and really hard stance against it. And for good reason. I mean, it is absolutely shameful what we do to animals in this country and in this world, and how we don't care for our environment, and how we just, you know, are eating foods that are likely destroying our, you know, health. But we have to meet people where they are, you know, and we have to be compassionate and empathetic towards people that are kind of on their own path. And we all come to this in our own ways. And I've just found that it's so much more impactful and successful and positive when you just lead by example and be the best version of yourself and just live your own life. And most of my friends here in Boulder aren't vegan, but they respect me for why I'm vegan and why I choose to do it, because I just come at it from a much more approachable, positive way. And I just am doing it in the way that I do it. And I laugh about it and we have fun and we go on bike rides and, you know, and then they're like, hey, you know, tell me about this plant-based diet thing, you know? And I think that's just my approach and, you know, that's just my personality. And maybe other people have found success in other ways, but I can only speak for my experience.
No, absolutely. I think it's very important because as within vegan communities, sometimes we tend to kind of isolate ourselves and mm-hmm. preach to the choir, only have vegan friends. So I think it is very important to kind of diffuse the walls and the boundaries and make yourself approachable. So if everybody, like the way I'm trying to live my life with this, and I'm as you, I most of my friends are not vegan, especially at work. I work in healthcare, so I'm blessed to have a few of them who are vegan friendly, but most of them are not vegan. But I don't want to ostracize people. I don't want to like come across as, you know, this categorical person that people are going to be running away from being scared. I want to, if anybody ever wants to go vegan or has a question about potentially doing it at one point, I want them to think of me as a person they can call and ask any question about being vegan that they can possibly ask. So that's how, kind of how I approach things as well.
Yeah, for sure. It's just the best way, I think, to, I mean, I'm such a believer in leading by example and just, you know, doing it, you know, for yourself and obviously doing it for a greater purpose, but it's just so much easier for people to lean in when, you know, they feel comfortable around it and they feel like you're open to having a discussion about it. And, you know, we live in a world now where sometimes people don't want to have conflicting discussions and they don't want to step on each other's toes, or people feel like they're walking around on eggshells. And as a result, nothing really productive, you know, productive conversations don't get had. And so as a result, it's so much, you know, we should strive to have interactions with people who have differing beliefs than us so that we can actually progress and move forward.
Absolutely. I mean, these are the conversations where you actually have a chance of learning something. You know, like if people have the same views as you do, how the hell you're ever supposed to learn anything?
Yeah, as Aaron and I always say, we have to step out of the vegan echo chamber. And I think what him and I are trying to do, and, you know, have tried to do in the past, is like be in that middle area between, you know, the rest of the US and then this really small little pocket of people that call themselves vegans, you know. And it's like, it's a very daunting task and kind of idealistic to think that everyone in the US is going to go vegan. And so we have to be able to bridge that gap and realize that there is this gray zone where we can make a huge amount of impact and a huge amount of positive change by having people kind of come over into the middle space and not be turned off by radical vegans telling them what they should or shouldn't eat for XYZ reasons, even if we agree with them. But it just, behavior change is a really crazy thing. And I think that's, it's important to understand why people change and how they change, and learning how to, you know, work with those people through those kinds of challenges.
Right. No, yeah, that's a really great message. I also think it's so cool that you were able to have the experiences that you had with your the racing experience and with your food choices that led you to lose a lot of weight and become unhealthy, to where you can now use that and pull from that and draw from that to be able to offer some of the strengths that you carried through that, and especially with the work that you do now, with the research that you're doing now, and with the way that you're engaged in the community, in the cycling community, and just athletic community in general. I just think it's really cool that you have that background. And I know that you spoke about it pretty briefly without getting into too much of a dark details especially, but I'm sure it was a very complicated time for you, being kind of on your own, this alone sport, and, you know, starving your body basically until the point that it became so weak. So it's really cool that you're doing the work that you are right now. And I'd love to get more into detail on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a really common, you know, issue for athletes, particularly endurance athletes, but also, you know, people like wrestlers and, you know, bodybuilders and strength, you know, athletes, both in the men and women's side. And I think it's, you know, more glorified and probably more forward facing from a media perspective in females, you know, disordered eating or eating disorders. And, but it's a real common and prevalent issue, on both sides. And, you know, I don't really consider what I had to be a full blown eating disorder. I think I was just had, you know, really negative habits around food and, you know, as kind of manifested as disordered eating, which I think is a very, you know, separate kind of thing than, you know, eating disorders like anorexia or bulimia or binge eating disorder. And so I think I'm much better off than a lot of people, unfortunately. I mean, you know, anorexia, I think, is the highest, death rate of any mental disorder, just because it's so hard on the body and it's so hard to escape that prison, mentally. And so it, you know, it is a dark place, and it's a really dark place to be so afraid of food or feel like you have such lack of control of food that it becomes this really dark negative cycle that you just, that's really hard to get out of. And unfortunately it's, like I said, very prevalent in athletes. And I think that's why it's a huge driver and a huge theme, a recurring theme that, that I talk about a lot, because I see it in a lot of people I know. I see it in a lot of people I don't know, and in athletes, and obviously it's not just in athletes, but it is a problem. And I think that that's why I like to talk about it, because there's an alternate path. It doesn't have to be this way. And unfortunately, I think the plant-based diet gets a lot of like negative reputation within the athletic community because people think that it is just another way to manifest an eating disorder and take, exclude certain foods from your diet and be restrictive and all of that. And sure, just like any diet, can be the diet of an eating disorder. Doesn't matter what you're eating or not eating. An eating disorder is it's a very serious topic. And so my goal is to bring more awareness to this, about this stuff, particularly with male athletes, just because I'm male and I know what it was like for me. But I think for plant-based athletes, I think there's a way to do it, obviously. And so it's an important, topic to cover for sure.
Mm-hmm. So I know that you're getting your master's of science in applied nutrition, and you're doing a lot of research in plant-based nutrition and endurance sports. Can you talk more about what are you finding, what are you learning, and perhaps how does a healthy plant-based diet may look different for those who are in endurance sports?
Yeah, totally. So, I'm kind of working on my thesis or my capstone project right now. So I'm finishing my master's. I'll be done in April, end of April. And the, this project I'm doing is I'm basically building a online course for plant-based athletes, a fully evidence-based course. And it's going to evolve over the years as I, continue to update it. But I want to create this resource that's really rooted in the evidence, that's fun and approachable and easy to work through, but that you'll get to learn a lot of stuff through video lectures and podcasts and recipes and different forms of media, and like I said, of course, really evidence-based. And so I'm right now kind of working through the literature review, going through all the research I can find. I'm not doing any original research or anything like that, but I'm basically taking a lot of what's already been done and kind of synthesizing it and doing my best to put it into an actual curriculum that is, approachable from a nutrition education perspective towards athletes that are either brand new to plant-based nutrition, or maybe they're not, plant-based, but they're curious about it, or they're already plant-based and they're, or they're vegan for ethical and environmental reasons, but they want to get into athletics, or they're already an athlete and they just want to make sure they're doing it right. Because honestly, one of the biggest problems that I see with the plant-based community and why I'm kind of going down this path is I see a lot of athletes that really struggle eating this way, because there are, despite what some people will tell you, it can be a challenge, and it's not just like you don't have to not think about it, that you do have to think about it. You have to plan it out. But with a few simple strategies, you can really do it effectively and not be super stressed out about it. But I digress. I think for plant-based athletes, it's tough, because I think, coming back to fiber, for example, we talk about there's like multiple camps in the plant-based community, right? There's people that are talking about the low fat, no oil, no salt, no sugar kind of diet, the Caldwell Esselstyn's and the, T. Colin Campbell's of the world. And even, Dr. Greger, these kind of like titans of the plant-based nutrition world, which have done amazing work, but they're really speaking to people that are diseased. Maybe they have, late stage heart disease, or they are type 2 diabetic, or they're overweight. Those are the kind of people that are needing to eat that way. And so I think what happens in a lot of cases is athletes, maybe they decide to go plant-based because they want to, have a better impact on the environment, or, have not contribute to animal, the factory farming system, or whatever the reasoning may be. They learn about plant-based nutrition through these kinds of doctors, and they start eating that way, and then they wonder why they feel fatigued and why their performance is dropping. And so all of that nutrition side is super important for a health perspective, but athletes are kind of a special population, because sure, they also want to prevent disease and live a long and healthy, thriving life. But we also do require a little bit more, nutrition that is kind of in a different category to that. And So I think my goal with this course and with everything I'm doing is to kind of help athletes realize that and recognize that, you know, there are nutrients of concern for athletes, you know, calories just in general. Like it's hard to get enough calories often as a plant-based endurance athlete, particularly if you're doing long distance running or cycling. Like, you're burning through so many more calories than the average person that if you're eating just pure, you know, salads and sweet potatoes and beans, like, it's going to be really hard to get enough calories to fuel that exercise. And so I think a lot of people want to go super whole food plant-based, but then they just don't get enough calories. And then they really struggle to meet that, the needs of their activity. So that's one thing. I think we also, you know, once we understand sort of, you know, the basic, you know, functions of certain nutrients like protein and iron, we can, you know, do our best to know what kinds of foods to eat to really maximize, you know, our intake and absorption of these things. Like iron, for example, you know, athletes do require higher intakes of iron because for runners, for example, when they run, they actually destroy red blood cells in their feet. And, you know, just from the impact alone, female athletes, you know, something I talk about a lot, because I'm definitely really interested in female athlete physiology, because I first learned about it in my exercise physiology course during my undergrad studies, and learned about this thing called the female athlete triad, which is this very common problem, and it applies to all female athletes, but I think more specifically to plant-based ones, where it's this kind of interrelationship between energy availability and having low, not meeting your caloric needs and energy needs, combined with low estrogen and female sex hormones, essentially, and then loss of your period, and so, or athletic amenorrhea, and this just causes a whole host of problems. I don't need to get into it, but you know, we have to consider things like vitamin D and calcium. Vitamin D and calcium are obviously very important nutrients for bone development and other functions for athletes. And so we have to be able to understand that we do have certain special requirements, and it's not super complicated. We don't have to make it complicated, but we just have to have a basic foundation of nutrition education, which is kind of what I'm trying to do.
That is really cool. I cannot wait for your course to come out. I think it's such a needed resource nowadays, and it can be so helpful to many athletes who are either, as you said, either transition into the plant-based nutrition or maybe looking to maximize their performance or improve their food intake. I ran my first marathon back in December. I was fundraising for the Humane League.
Congrats.
Thank you. Yeah, it was an amazing experience. I ran a half marathon last year, and the year before, and then a full marathon this past December. But as I was training for that, I think I had a lot of the same issues, to where I was trying to do the plant-based, the low-fat plant-based diet at the same time where I was putting all these miles preparing for my first marathon and being working full time and being in school full time. So I don't think I was getting enough calories either. And I had a lot of other friends who are women who are kind of going through the same thing. So can you talk a little bit more, like, from the point of application, what does it look like? So getting enough calories and then ensuring that you get all of your kind of important nutrients, specifically for those who are doing an endurance training, such as you said, the iron and the calcium and the other vitamins that, you know, that you're regular, the B12 and DHAs and vitamin D. What are some of the day-to-day things that one can do to meet the calorie requirement and the vitamin requirement?
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I think, you know, a good place to start with that is that, you know, a plant-based diet inherently is going to be, have more volume than a standard diet. I think that's one of the big problems that athletes face when they go from a standard diet. Like, a lot of, you know, athletes, cyclists that I, you know, teammates and stuff that I grew up with, as we all know, when you're young, like, you're just, when you're training a lot, like, you can just plow through hamburgers and French fries and ice cream. And just because your body is, like, in this state of just needing calories and fuel. And so it's just, you can get away with it. And obviously that's very basically doesn't have any fiber in it. And so it's not taking up a lot of space in your stomach. It's not, you know, it's very calorie rich and, you know, nutrient poor. And so when you switch to a plant-based diet and you start to see, you know, these diets from, you know, the Esselstyns or, you know, other people that are kind of like bigger mainstream kind of plant-based or vegan proponents, you see these like huge salads with like beans and potatoes and cabbage and all these raw fruits and vegetables. And you're like, wow, that's okay. This, I guess, this is how you do the plant-based diet. And you eat that and it's like 200 calories, but you're like extremely full just physically, you know? And then you're like pooping the rest of the night because you just, it's like it's so much for your body to handle, but your body's actually not really getting anything out of that except for all of those amazing nutrients and antioxidants and, you know, just the fiber and all these things that are obviously very beneficial. And it's a big reason why people that are overweight or are struggling with chronic disease lose a lot of weight and gain a lot of their health back is because of that, you know, calorie density and, you know, higher volume of food kind of thing, because it actually physically stretches your stomach out and stretches those stretch receptors to signal to your brain that you're full. But that's a double-edged sword for athletes, because as a result of that, you know, it's going to be really hard to maintain your training volume and your, you know, to running a marathon. You're not going to be able to run a marathon if you're eating, you know, going from eating 3,000 calories a day on your normal diet to dropping down to half that, you know, to 1,500 calories a day, because you're just, you seem like you're eating the same amount of food. Your body feels like it's eating the same amount of food, but you're not getting the same amount of calories, which is going to be fueling that. And, you know, I think that's obviously a big thing. And I think athletes, you know, there's a spectrum, right? There's people that are wanting to be really high performance elite athletes training for, you know, different competitions, or they are professional athletes. And then there's athletes that are a little bit more recreational and just want to be, you know, functioning, you know, and healthy and using exercise as a tool for, you know, self-care and just, a meditative thing, or just they want to be outside, or they just want to feel good. And so there's a little bit of leeway there, but the calorie density thing is a huge thing. And kind of going along part and parcel with that is the protein issue. And I think a lot of people there's still a big misconception about protein in the athlete community. And it's just kind of mind boggling to me that we still are having this discussion. But, you know, if you're eating enough calories, essentially you're going to be eating enough protein, because there's protein in all living tissues, including plants. And you can get all of the essential amino acids. That in certain high-level athletes, it can be tough to get enough protein, especially branched-chain amino acids from plants. But as long as you're eating enough calories to fuel your intensity and your training load, you're going to be fine. And there's actually, in the research, there's not a lot of really strong, you know, convincing data that eating a significantly amount more protein than the average person is actually going to improve your performance. There's not a huge consensus on that. And so, yeah, it's really about just getting enough calories. And I know that sounds like kind of a no-brainer, but it's actually a lot harder than I think we think. And so, especially if you're in the world of athletics that are involved with, okay, I'm trying to lose weight, I have to think about food, I have to restrict a little bit so I can lose weight, so I can be lean. You kind of have to throw those things out the window, and it's hard. It's really hard, but I struggle with it to this day. And it's something that we have to work on consistently, but you have to throw those things out the window at a certain point, because, you know, if you're in a restrictive mindset, it's going to be hard to get exactly what you need. And so that's the calorie thing. I think that, you know, athletes like other, you know, plant-based humans should be supplementing with B12. Absolutely, you know, no, that's a, you know, there's just no debate there. We need to take B12. I think most humans, even if you are eating animal products, should take B12. It's super easy. It's super cheap. And it's a really critical vitamin for athletes. It's, you know, involved in nerve signaling and nerve development. So that's a no brainer. I think, DHA and EPA, long chain omega-3 fatty acids, helping with inflammation, brain development, all of that. Iron is a tricky one. Athletes do recommend, they do require more iron than the average person, kind of like I mentioned earlier. And then plant-based athletes require even more because plant sources, non-heme iron is less bioavailable than heme iron, which is found in animals. And all of the phytates and polyphenols that we eat, including like tannins and tea and coffee, inhibit the absorptions a little bit. So it's recommended that athletes that are plant-based take in, I think, like 1.8 times the recommended intake for the average person. So kind of the best evidence that we have to support that is going to be 32 milligrams of iron per day for men. And then, for women, sorry, because women require more, and 14 milligrams for men. And so this right here is the crux for plant-based athletes that are female, because iron is very important for athletics. Obviously it's an important precursor for developing, for oxygen uptake in the body. And women have a menstrual cycle, and so they're losing blood every month, so they require more iron. And so things like legumes, leafy greens, I'm a huge fan of blackstrap molasses. I eat it every day. I put it's an acquired taste, but I put it in my oatmeal every morning. Simple things like that. You just have to kind of find those habits of like thinking about food. You don't want to think about too much of breaking it into, a reductionist approach, but we just have to be a little bit more mindful. And I think once you kind of get it down to a certain extent, it just becomes second nature.
Yeah. But I also really think it's really interesting, like, to kind of let your curiosity take over sometimes and learn about science too, because I really enjoy it. So I know you guys did the What's the Deal with Fiber, but you also did What's the Deal with Iron a while ago, and I really enjoyed that episode. And then, like, some of the cool things that I took with me was, first, as you mentioned, that like caffeine, it kind of blocks some of the absorption of iron. So if you're eating your whatever the iron food for the day that you think is going to be whatever the blackstrap molasses, or if you're trying to get your iron in, then you don't want to drink coffee or green tea or in the caffeinated drinks within like 2 hours or something before and after. And then the second thing, as you also mentioned in your episode, is the vitamin C really helps with absorption of iron, if I understand correctly. So like if you're eating your legumes, for example, dark leafy greens, just throw in a little bit of like, I don't know, some pepper. What is it called? The spice.
Bell pepper.
Yeah. Bell pepper, that's right. My Ukrainian is coming out. either the bell pepper or just some citrusy fruit will help the absorption of iron as well, and will help your body to get more of that.
Yeah, so I mean, I also recognize that not everyone is absolute nerds like you and I are about nutrition and food. And so it's, I also want to help. I need to learn how to help. And that's part of, my interest in nutrition education is like, how do we communicate these things to people that don't want to take the time to learn about this stuff, but, also want to incorporate it and have a solid foundation. And I mean, there is a certain level of requirement for that, but yeah, it's like, that's a perfect example. It's like, once you just, know those basic things about iron, for example, you can just be better off. And then it just like kind of pops up in your mind when you're making a meal. You can be a little bit more mindful, a little bit more calculated about what you're putting into your body and why. And I think as athletes, like, we're already very motivated to change, and we're motivated to, do things that are going to help improve our performance. We buy new shoes or, some new Garmin watch, or we go out at 5 a.m. to train before work because that's the only time we have. Why not take a little bit more time to think about our food and why we're eating certain things and buying food that's going to really help improve our performance and our health. And I just think that it's something that is so underrated and yet so important.
Yeah. Tell me, what are some of your favorite, either like pre or post long runs or long rides, fruits or anything that you take with you, like in terms of snacks or granola bars or energy bowls or whatever?
Yeah. I mean, I, for those of you that, that know about, you know, Thought for Food or any of our videos and stuff, it's like, I'm a huge fan of smoothie bowls and and just smoothies in general. I think they're essential for every athlete because, again, it's like, it's often hard when we're, you know, training super hard and we're eating all the time and we also have other things going on in our lives. Like, it can be exhausting to eat as much food as we need to as plant-based people, especially if we're trying to eat a healthy diet and not just exist on, you know, white rice and maple syrup. And so smoothies are great because it kind of pre-digests the food to a certain extent. And it's just easy to eat that, like, and you can make it super packed with food and nutrients and also make it super delicious. And so, I like smoothie bowls because you can pack an insane amount of calories into something that is delicious and also pretty easy to eat. It doesn't feel like you've eaten, you know, the same amount of food in a big salad bowl. And so I'll put bananas and berries and, you know, spinach, and I'll put kale, or I'll put blackstrap molasses in there and turmeric, and I just load up everything I have, and then I'll top it with granola and more berries and more nuts and seeds and almond butter. And so it's like after a, you know, 6 hour, 100 mile ride in the summer, that's what I'm craving. My body just has gotten used to that. And it's like, it's perfect recovery meal too, because the fruit is, you know, just easily digested and absorbed carbohydrate, you know, help to replenish that glycogen that you've lost during that ride. There's a lot of water content in there for hydration and just, you know, in general, just pretty high in calories, which is obviously super important for an athlete that's plant-based. And so I always recommend to everyone that asks, you know, that question, it's like smoothie bowls hands down. And then you just have to, you know, self-experiment. And I think that's also just a really important, you know, piece of advice that I have, is that we are our own guinea pig and we are the N of one. And so we, you know, we have to learn how to experiment on ourselves. We're all so different. We all engage in different activities and have different lives and have different digestive systems to a certain extent. And so playing around with what you eat before and after a workout, you can follow the recommendations. You can look at what the research says, you know, and apply that. But there's also a lot of flexibility there and learning how to listen to your body, A, and B, you know, take what your body is telling you and kind of dial it in and tweak it. And that's one of my favorite parts about being an athlete and being someone so interested in nutrition is, you know, we can do that and we can create these habits and these, you know, ways of living our lives through food and through exercise that become meaningful and that, you know, that we can start to see improvements and work on it, through that self-experimentation.
Yeah, I really like what you said about learning to listen to your body too and kind of tweaking and adjusting the practices to your body as well. I think that's something that I for sure learned too through like training for the marathon and having to adjust and see what foods and what time worked and what didn't work. I had a really hard time learning how to eat like before racing and during, because I like used to run. I never really ran like races in general or professionally at all. I was just kind of doing it for fun and for, you know, for nature, for the scenery mostly. So once I started running longer distances, I would never eat before running. And like my first half marathon that I ran, I almost passed out at the end because I like didn't eat anything. I had tons of coffee and I ran 13 miles without really training a whole lot. So I had somebody who was helping me train for this one, for the full marathon. A girl, her name is Jackie Merritt, and she ran Western States before. She ran like tons of really cool races, including the 100 miler, the Western States. So she was like, you have to eat. You have to like figure out whatever you can force into yourself, but you're going to have to like at some point start eating. And I remember like first time I tried eating something and I saw such an amazing improvement in my like endurance. Like I ran 13 miles and I could continue going without like dying. So it was really, really cool, and like gradually figuring out what it is that worked for me on as part of the racing, and like before or during, and figuring out how my body reacts into different things. It was like a really cool experience. I feel like you get connected to your body in a different way, and you learn to understand this machine that you were given to, you know, to roam around the world.
Yeah, totally. And it's like, I mean, that's why I'm, you know, really excited, and why I like working with athletes is, you know, it's sort of low hanging fruit. It's like, we, you know, obviously are still humans first and foremost, but we're also the kind of humans that are excited and motivated to change. And we see those results. We see those changes. We're open to self-experimentation, and we are connected with our body. And of course there's, you know, lots of people that need help with their diet and lifestyle. But I found that the athletes, you know, I can really relate to in that way. And you know, one thing that is just such a critical thing in this age of technology and social media, and just being inundated with stimulus all the time, and having all of these, you know, Garmin watches and sleep trackers and all of these things, it's like we're losing the ability to just like tap into our body and listen to what it's telling us. And so that's a big goal of mine, I think, in general, and not just in athletics, but just in general. It's like we just don't have the time to slow down. And as a result, I think it's a big reason why we're so disconnected from our food system, from what we're putting into our body and how it affects us. And I think we could all do a little bit of a better job to learn how to listen to our bodies.
Right. No, that's such a great point. I find it a lot too. It's like, we're, as you said, we're so disconnected that we have to like rely on these formulas and these applications telling us what to do and what time to go to bed and how many calories to eat and what's the proportion of the carbs versus protein versus fat.
Yeah.
But really, if we just like were able to quiet down the noise around us and to kind of turn inward and listen a little bit more, then we would have no worries figuring out what should be the next food choice, or what time we should go to bed, or, you know, if we should be a yes or no to the next endeavor that somebody is throwing at us. But yeah, that's a really good point.
Totally, totally.
Okay, tell me about some of the other projects you're working on, because I know there are a few more. You're also a part of the podcast. You have your own YouTube channel. You do this amazing short films and videos that you're passionate about.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess for those of you that know about Thought for Food, I mean, we started that in January of 2016. And that's sort of what kind of launched us, you know, myself and Aaron, into this world of plant-based nutrition and lifestyle. You know, just a few weeks ago, we kind of decided to close that chapter for a number of reasons. And I mean, namely just the fact that we're just incredibly busy, and Aaron's going back to school and has two young kids, and we just don't have the time and energy to give to that right now. And I'm trying to finish school and focus on, you know, this thesis project and this course. And we just kind of reached this point where we recognize that, you know, it just felt right to close that door and see where it leads. You know, one door closes, it another door opens, kind of thing.
Yeah,
and it was a great experience. You know,
I just want to say that there's probably like 1,000 people, well, at least 1,000 people, that are walking around the world wearing all black since you guys announced that you're closing down the podcast, because they're mourning. And yeah. I mean, I'm definitely very excited for you for all of your future endeavors. But damn, it was one of my favorite podcasts.
I know, it was great, and trust me, I'm mourning just like everyone else. But it was time, and it was a tough decision, and it was sort of a long time coming, I think. Like we'd been talking about it for a little while, and but again, like it's not like Aaron and I are just disappearing off the face of the earth and, you know, going to go work at the local McDonald's. Like we, you know, it's like we're still very much passionate about this stuff, and are still going to collaborate in many cool ways. And we have a ton of ideas. It's just that, you know, life is crazy and it ebbs and flows. And I think one of the things that I see a lot in not only this space, but just elsewhere, is that people kind of force their way through projects because they have always done it and they just feel like they need to keep going. When in fact, you know, trying to push through that resistance doesn't always really lead anywhere. And, but sort of letting it go and letting it settle for a little bit can actually open up the mind and clear that space for something else cool. And so I really like change. I really like, moving forward, and it feels really exciting to me to kind of clear the slate off and have a fresh start. And so, there's a lot of projects on the horizon. I mean, I think podcasting is one of my favorite things in the world, and I want to keep doing it. I'm producing and co-hosting a podcast right now, called the Fast Cat Cycling Training Tips Podcast with a coach here in town. It's very, very cycling nerd focused, but it's a fun little project that I'm working on right now. But I want to start my own. I want to start a new one, and so stay tuned for that. I'm sure I will let everyone know, but I have some ideas. It's in the works, and but again, my main focus right now is school. But I have a lot of interest in kind of creating a new platform. And obviously it's not going to be crazy different than Thought for Food. I'm still Jackson. I still have the same personality, the same things I like to talk about.
The same golden voice.
Yeah. The same silky, smooth, sultry baritone will be gracing your ears very soon. I promise you. I love it. It's like, and part of me feels like, it's that I'm good at it. And so it's like, I enjoy that process of recording podcasts. And I think it's a beautiful medium, and I have a lot to share and talk about. And so, I'm not giving up, I want to start a new chapter, I guess.
No, yeah, absolutely. And I just want to say, well, first of all, thank you for all the time and research that you guys put into the podcast. I mean, I learned so much from it, and just as much as I learned from it, like intellectually and in terms of like evidence and the science that you presented, it also like inspired me and drove me and made me smile and made me laugh so many times through like some hard times and training or just, I don't know, shitty days, because you guys just put like so much soul into that. And being able to bring to the light like some of the issues that you were working on through personally, like some of the, the exercise addiction stuff, or, like some of the concerns that different people have with food. I mean, it was just amazing product that you put with so much soul and love in. And then another thing that I wanted to mention is it kind of like when you were talking about moving on to the next chapter and stopping it, not because you were giving up, but because you were ready for something new. It also reminded me the way that maybe you approached your cycling to a degree, right? You're making sure that you're having fun with whatever you're doing, that you're making sure that you're kind of putting yourself and acting as a human before being a scientist or athlete or a nutritionist or anybody else, and being a happy human. So why not? I mean, if it doesn't make you happy, if it doesn't spark joy in you, then maybe something else that you can try. I was listening to the Rob Bell a while ago. I think he was doing an episode with Elizabeth Gilbert right around New Year's Day. And they were talking about how something doesn't have to be bad or unbearable or hurtful in order for you to live it. Like, you can live things when it's still good, and it's okay to live it if you know if it's the right thing. So I applaud you for, again, having the courage to live when things are still good, and to not being afraid to start with a new slate and build something new and something else that's exciting and just as good, or maybe 1,000 times better.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, thank you for those kind words. I really truly appreciate that. And I appreciate everyone that kind of followed us and supported us and through that journey. And it was a beautiful thing, and I don't regret any of it. And it was just amazing project. And we got to connect with so many amazing people and learn so much ourselves. It was very much for ourselves as it was for other people. And so, it's kind of like what you mentioned. It's like, we as humans evolve, and I never want to stop evolving and learning and changing and moving forward. And sometimes it just doesn't exactly, work to be continuing to do the same, going through the same motions of whatever project you're doing. And it doesn't have to be, some sort of creative thing, but it could be a relationship. It could be a diet. It could be an exercise routine. And you know, even in the past year, I've evolved so much as an athlete and getting more into running and strength training and just balancing out my body as an athlete and as a human athlete, more importantly. And so I just, yeah, it's like, it's such a beautiful journey to be able to learn all these things about myself. I'm still young. And so it's like, I still have plenty of time to make mistakes and learn these things. But at the same time, I also find it extremely rewarding to be just okay with change and uncertainty and learn, you know, learn how to evolve and move past, you know, certain areas of my life that I don't feel like are necessarily serving me.
Yeah. No, that's really, really cool. So when are you guys opening your crystal shop where you're going to be practicing the chakra magic?
Well, the lease is already signed. It's just, we have a couple more hurdles to jump through, a couple more hoops. It's a lot harder to procure crystals. I mean, especially when we have to, you know, we're really specific and picky about our crystals. They come straight from the Mayan ruins. And so it's a lot of hoops to jump through to get those crystals, not only to the US, but, you know, we generally steal them. And so as a result, it's, you know, Aaron and I have both been arrested multiple times in the past year trying to get these crystals here. We're just trying to serve people. We're trying to help people. Those obsidian crystals are, you know, the genuine ones come from the ancient ruins, you know, down in the Yucatan. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have a little bit of a connections left with my previous background in Ukraine and Russia with contraband. So if you guys need any help or any rental space in the containers that are going through, just let me know. I can make some.
I'll be in touch. Yeah, I'll be in touch.
Oh, I love it so much. Okay, well, I have a final question that I usually ask before I close out, but I wanted to see if there's anything else that you want to share, any parting words of wisdom or anything that maybe we didn't discuss that you want to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple things, I guess. I mean, one thing just in general, just throwing it out there is just, you know, for anyone listening, don't take any of this so seriously. You know, life is supposed to be fun, and especially with diet and our lifestyle, it's like, yeah, we can be extreme nerds like myself, you know, and go into the extreme of the science. And it's a deep, dark rabbit hole, you know, in PubMed and in the research. And, but at the same time, like, we still have to live our lives and we have to have fun and enjoy it. Enjoy the process and give ourselves, you know, some care and compassion, because none of this stuff matters if we're just trapped in our minds. And I'm still struggling with it a lot. I'm working through it a lot. And so I like to talk about that. I also like to talk about, and I think this is relatable to starting new projects or podcasts or, you know, school or jobs, is that I've become very annoyed and very disconnected from this hustle culture that has permeated our world of, you know, on the grind and hustling and, you know, kind of trying to work way harder than everyone and be overproductive. Sometimes the best thing that we can do is slow down and take breaks from things and, disconnect from social media, go for a walk outside, spend some time with the people that you care about and watch a movie. It's that self-care is so critical, and it's been on my mind lately. So, both of those things in conjunction, I think are important to keep in mind as we pursue our wildest dreams.
Yeah, no, I love it. I really much need this message to know with all the things that I have on my plate too. But yeah, what I keep thinking about is like, there's always going to be something else. There's always going to be more things to do. Like if you really want to, your to-do list will never be over. And we really set our own pace. Like the faster we run, the more things pass by us. And if we just choose to slow down, then we have more time to take things in and really experience them and really to see what it is that we can get from them. So that's such a great message nowadays.
Totally.
Okay. Well, the last question that I usually ask has to do with the name of my podcast. So the name of my podcast is Follow Your Kind. And it comes from it is around kindness, because I believe that we're all brought into this world originally being kind, and then through different experiences that happen to us, sometimes we unlearn that skill, or maybe we're not mindful about the consequences of our actions. But really deep down, I really believe that if you were to ask a person if you want to be kind, most of the people would say yes. So I'm always curious about how different people define their value of kindness, and then what decisions they make through the days to intentionally follow through with that value and to follow their kind. So what is your kind, and how do you get to follow it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it kind of comes back to what I was talking about just a minute or two ago about, you know, I think we have to be first and foremost kind to ourselves, and then that kind of ripples outwards. And I think a lot of our suffering and struggles come from being a prisoner of our own mind and not taking care of ourselves mentally. And so I think the way that I sort of express kindness towards myself, and then as a result to others, is by being in a calm and content and comfortable headspace. And I do that through meditation every day, every morning, even just 10 minutes. But even aside from just pure meditation, but just, you know, doing things in our days, whether it's a bike ride or a run, or, you know, mindfully putting together a really beautiful meal that you're really proud of and that makes you feel good, like, that's kindness. And sharing that meal with someone, or sharing that bike ride with someone, or, you know, taking a really beautiful picture that just reminds you of, you know, brings you back to that moment of being at the top of a mountain, or, you know, standing on the beach with your friend. I feel like that is just like the epitome of kindness. And I think even something as simple as that can really become amplified and ripple out to ways that, you know, we can't necessarily see in that moment, or see its effects when it's actually happening down the line, but it's creating those habits and those positive loops in our mind instead of constantly being in the negative loops. So I hope that made sense and it wasn't too abstract.
No, I love it. I don't think I've ever heard that from anyone yet. So what I'm hearing is, through being your happiest self and through living your happiest, most fulfilling life, is that how you get to be kind to yourself and to the world, by just bringing your brightest spark to it? That is so cool.
Yeah. I think it's hugely underrated. And I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of talk about self-care these days, and I think it's really true. You know, we have to be able to take care of ourselves and be, you know, find that flow state of positivity, because I think most of us probably go through our day, myself included, and are just looping negative thoughts in our mind all day without even realizing it. And that becomes our reality, you know, and it just inevitably rubs off on other people, how we interact with our friends, our loved ones, strangers. And if we can create habits each day in multiple ways, whether it's a daily meditation practice, whether it's yoga, whether it's eating really good food that you feel like is really nourishing you, all of those things do add up in ways that we don't really recognize immediately. And it ripples out, like I said, to a bigger scale.
I love it. Being good to yourself, you're being good to others.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Well, thank you so much, Jackson, for being the guest today. Thank you for letting me take so much of your time and for sharing all of your wisdom and experience and letting us enjoy your voice for 1 hour and 36 minutes.
Yes, it's my pleasure. It's always fun to do this, to be on the other side of the microphone. And I'm really honored that you invited me on. So thank you.
Thank you.